In this segment of the IRWE project to record some of the history of radio and electronics in South Australia, I'm speaking today to Mr. John Allen. Welcome, John. Maybe we could commence by asking you how you first became interested in radio equipment.
Well, that goes, Ian, that goes back to my high school days. When quite a lot of those who got a start in the radio industry did so by building crystal sets at high school.
Could we ask roughly when that was?
Yes, that was in 1926. Pal and I became involved in this sort of thing. He went on and did something else, but I stayed with the interest, or at least originally I was destined to become a draftsman or architect in an architect's office. But the time I left high school, the building industry was in the early stages of depression, and architects weren't employing anybody at that stage more than they had to. In fact, they were putting staff off. So I then looked around and approached Edison Swan, who were then in Warando Buildings, Grenfell Street, which incidentally is being demolished, I noticed today, for a job there. Well, I wasn't successful, but because of the fact that I'd shown some interest in the particular aspect that they wanted me to join, they put me in touch with another electrical house, or electrical manufacturer's agent would be the better term, in Chester Street City, which was still in Miranda Buildings, but around the corner. They were importing quite a bit of stuff from overseas, and in particular they had the local distribution of the QRS music roll. And this got me then involved with the music side of the entertainment industry. And I stayed with them for about 3 years until the opposition, Master Touch Music Rolls, absorbed QRS, and I went from QRS to the Master Touch distributor here, who was then operating under the business name of D. Harris and Company, David Harris. And I joined David Harris and his brother Don in their small venture at that stage into radio. They were distributing Australian made and some imported radio equipment, and that was about the time that the Commonwealth government introduced a high duty on overseas manufactured radio.
You're talking about domestic?
Yeah, domestic radio. Yes. Well, yes, entirely domestic radio. So with the loss of those particular agencies, we started off in a very small way of making radio, building radio receivers. But that was not by a long shot the beginning of radio production in Adelaide. It had been going on for some years with a number of other manufacturers, Bland Radio, for instance, and or one or two others, the people who set up 5KA in 1927 had produced quite a lot of radio receivers for the domestic market at that stage. But anyway, we broke into it, and starting off with battery sets, and then pure DC sets. There were no suitable rectifiers at that particular stage to produce AC-DC radios, and of course the conventional domestic AC-powered radio. So we built up quite a substantial business. Now this is around about 1930 at this stage. Myers had moved into Adelaide in 1928, and they'd set up a radio department, and most of the other major retailers in the Rundle Street area had done likewise, and we started making receivers for these various retailers. And it's just staggering, the volume, the stuff that was disposed of. Overseas Cricket gave it a great fillip.
Oh, yes.
And you'd be flat out night and day building little tune rectifiers for the demand due to the overseas cricket.
What brand name did they go under?
Radion, R-A-D-I-O-N. And I think I gave Telecom Museum a few bits and pieces with that name on it in recent months or years. So this kept us busy, and when suitable valves became available, we started to make AC/DC sets, because there was still a big demand in the country areas where the country towns were still using DC.
Yes.
When we first started making the DC sets, we never had access to 200 volts DC in the building where we were located, although 200 volts DC was still available in some buildings around the city. But what we did, we used to do our testing of the DC receivers at night when nobody was about by getting up into the lift loft and tapping off 200 volts DC and piping it down to our workroom on the the same floor. Yes, that's right. We were on the top floor, so we didn't have fire to run it. And we'd get our 200-volt DC sets through that way. But, of course, once the suitable high filament voltage rectifier became available and the Beretta filament series resistor, the whole thing became quite easy. Then we just checked them the same as you would an AC set.
Yes, so your career really started when you left school, you might say. You
know? Virtually, yes, when I left school, yes. In a very small way initially, but gradually building up from there.
And what was your role in that manufacturing?
Oh, producing winding coils, winding IF transformers, building the receivers, testing them, and so on, outside service work where necessary, and... Oh, it was extraordinary, the range of loudspeakers, for instance, that were available in those days. The Ducon people in Sydney, who were producing capacitors, they started to make a loudspeaker called the Jubilee loudspeaker, which we used a lot of, Roller we used a lot of, Jensen. And there was a people in Melbourne made a loudspeaker under the name of Monitor. I've forgotten the name of the folk involved, but we use a lot of those too. Pardon me. A lot of those too. So we got by fairly well. Yeah. Initially, we never had electrolytic capacitors. We used the 4 microfarad paper dielectric capacitors. And the strife we used to have with the early... electrolytic capacitors are unbelievable, blowing tops out of them.
That's with a solution.
Yes, solution splashing all over the cabinets and internally. But they eventually got it right. Ducon had a lot of strife with their capacitors, mostly on the paper dielectric stage. And finally traced to fumes from a pickle factory across the road, was wafting in through their factory and in some way disturbing the lifespan of paper dielectric capacitors and micro dielectric capacitors. But they eventually got the electrolytic capacitor, fluid electrolytic capacitors, under control. And in those days, very few people had means of measuring the efficacy of or efficiency of a electrolytic capacitor. You popped it on if you were comparing makes, popped it on a receiver, and if it reduced the hum, it was a better capacitor. And one of the manufacturers woke up to this fact that we had no way other than that method of proving the point, so he made all his 8 microfarads up round 12 to 16 microfarad capacitor. Naturally, they reduced the hum level in this primitive test, and therefore they got the business. It's incredible to look back on
marketing in the early days, eh?
Oh, yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. Then there's the vibrator power supply for domestic radios. We never made any car radios, but we did make a lot of domestic radios. And that would take us up to the mid-30s when Harrison Company decided to get out of radio. It was getting very, very competitive and moved into the movie picture talkie realm by building the Roxy Theatre on Anzac Highway. And I changed over to Ernst Smith's manufacturing subsidiary called National Radio Corporation.
Oh, yes.
Ernst Smith initially were buying all their radio requirements from manufacturers around the city and interstate, finally deciding to go into production for their own needs and also producing for the unbranded market, putting anybody's name, whatever label they required on them. So they initially started out in the basement of Orando Buildings, and I joined them in 1936 after they'd moved to Pirie Street. And I went there purely by accident, really. I was doing the night course down at the School of Mines under Wilf Honner in those days, Wireless 1, Wireless 2, and I think Wireless 3. And National had got into trouble with a heap of AC-DC dual wave receivers. And the factory manager, Elof Lindberg, sent a message down to Wilf Honner, could he recommend somebody that helped them sort this problem out? So I started with National on a purely temporary basis, was to find the fault with this batch of AC-DC dual wave receivers, which had no performance on the short wave band. In those days, the dual wave receiver, if you didn't have a dual wave receiver, you were just nobody. Mm. These things were destined for Kalgoorlie, which was a big DC operated town in those days. And I eventually sorted it out. It's rather interesting. It was necessary to decouple the local oscillator for short wave reception so that the audio didn't modulate the high tension to the local oscillator and therefore started fluttering in time with the signal, received signal fluttering in time in beat or in time with the audio component. So to do beat this, you decouple the power supply to the anode of the local oscillator with a series capacitor and 8 microfarad electrolytic.
Series.
And this smooths out the audio component waffling about the high tension line. And but what they forgot to allow for was the most unsatisfactory RF handling capability of electrolytic capacitor. Right. And didn't take long to find out that when I bypassed this same point with, say, a 004 microcapacitor, the thing functioned quite normally. So the power factor. The power factor, the electrolytic capacitor, was such that it was useless at over the spectrum of 3 megs, say, to 16 or something in that order. Anyway, the small 004 microcapacitor fixed that problem, and I was quite happy at the end of the 3 weeks after I'd set them all up and going to have gone on my way again, but it was decided that I ought to stay, and I stayed. So that's how I got involved with National Radio Corporation. A wee which is churning out the conventional domestic radio receivers by the hundreds. One little side issue, we got involved with motor tune sets. We had a lot of trouble there mechanically, getting the motor tuning units made here locally. Just couldn't be produced with sufficient degree of accuracy to be dependable. So we didn't get very far with that project. We built a few and then we abandoned those.
Were they kind of push buttons?
Yeah, push button, and the little motor just started up and ran along to the setting at which you'd pressed whichever button you'd pressed and then cut out. And this was the problem. We had overshoot, and then she'd start hunting backwards and forwards across the spot. And we never really solved that problem, mainly because, I say, the basic equipment could not be made with sufficient degree of accuracy here in Adelaide. The quantities were too small to set up any real high-class pressing and what have you to do the job. It was a reduction gear, a little high-speed electric motor geared down to drive the tuning capacitor.
Did they have any automatic fine tuning or automatic tuning adjustments?
No, no AFC. AWA were making a similar equipment, and they copied the RCA American receiver with automatic frequency control. Yes. But the type of equipment we were building, or at least the market we were building it for, we just had to do away with these little luxuries and try and get the thing working without AFC and other niceties. Anyway, we finally abandoned that, but we produced an amazing range of receivers over the years, a wide range of, very wide range of vibrator-powered 6-volt operated receivers for country use.
Yes.
They were very successful and quite a popular demand for those. Around about 1938-39, Ernst Smith sold out their manufacturing subsidiary, National Radio Corporation, to Electronic Industries. Pardon me. Electronic Industries, or at least Radio Corporation as it was, the Astor people, Radio Corporation in those days, were running into difficulties with both AWA and Philips started making valves in Australia, and this put Radio Corporation more or less at the mercy of AWA and Philips with a supply of valves.
Yes.
They had, up till that stage, always imported Sylvania valves from North America, and this was cut off, of course, as soon as Philips and AWA started making valves. So they saw their future lie in expansion, so that they could demand an equal share of valve production and what have you. So they started buying up small radio business around Australia, which they did quite successfully, and National Radio Corporation was one of them. So I changed loyalties from Ernst Smith's to Electronic Industries. And this appeared to be very successful. pardon me, they'd bought out EZ Radio, Eclipse Radio, and I think one or two others in the eastern states, and this gave them sufficient volume to demand respect for their needs of valves here in Australia. And I stayed there with still National Radio Corporation, but as a subsidiary of Electronic Industries until 1941, when I enlisted in the RAAF to join the radar venture. And I spent 4 years with the RAF, and then I came back to National Radio Corporation and continued producing domestic radio equipment until 1950, when it's becoming evident that the continued production of radio by Electronic Industries subsidiaries was becoming an economic proposition. And it was evident also that the manufacturing aspect of National Radio Corporation was eventually peter out. So I decided to kick off on my own, and with a small radio manufacturing and amplifier manufacturing business and service work. And I did this for the next 35 years.
And how did you get on for parts?
No problem, because I wasn't involved with any volume. So I had no problem getting parts ever. Then I moved away from the domestic aspect of it into the commercial use of amplifiers, hotels, hospitals and churches and what have you, the general setup. Then I got involved with the medical profession. That's an interesting long story. I started making medical equipment, or certain types of medical equipment, and this together with the normal domestic activities kept me going, and I didn't make a fortune, but I didn't go broke. Three or four years ago, I decided the time was time to quit. And there you are, you have it. I'm finished.
Right.
With the radio industry.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about your time in the RAF and some of the problems you had there with propagation and so on?
Very well, Ian. I joined the RAF and did the usual rookies training. I went in with commission rank to become a radar officer in the RAAF and did the initial administrative and special duties course, and then up to the radar school, as it eventually became, as the RDF school originally, radar school at Richmond, and having completed that about the end of February 42, I was attached to number 6 squadron with Hudson's for experience in operating the ASV Mark II radar equipment that the Hudson aircraft had been equipped with at that stage. Spent a short time with them, just enough to get the experience necessary in the operational use of airborne radar, and then I put in the air warning system for Brisbane, installed 4 stations there, and I stayed there in the Brisbane area as local area radar officer until about July 42, when I received a phone call from the director of RDF, as it was in those days, Wing Commander Pither, to come on down to Melbourne and help them with the production, development and production of the radar equipment was now starting to get made in Australia, because it was getting too difficult to get equipment from UK, and in any case the equipment coming from UK was too massive to be used as transportable equipment for the island hopping technique that was obviously going to be used to get back into our own territories. So I joined George in Pither, George Pither in Melbourne, in about July, August 42. And I joined the ground section. We had the air section, the ground section, and publication section. And the object of the exercise was that we all get busy getting stuff into the field.
Yeah.
And this is the main object of getting this group together. People with experience in the radio industry, particularly in the design and manufacturing of radio equipment, to help getting this stuff into production and out into the field. But I related to you just a minute ago this problem that we had with the ground-based stations. We ran into this unusual phenomena of a ground-based station that would normally have a surface cover of about 30 miles range and something up to 100 to 120 miles on aircraft, would suddenly aircraft would be cut off and the range on surface vessels would go out only to 100 or 120 miles also, which was quite useless from the point of view of equipment designed for air warning. In fact, it became useless for air warning. So I was given the job of finding out what was going on, because at this stage we wasn't sure whether our equipment was at fault or our technique was at fault. And one of the amateurs, incidentally, the majority of the staff were not only from the radio industry, but they were also pre-war amateur operators, some with commercial licenses like myself, but most of the others with amateur ticket. And one of them mentioned to me he remembered reading in QST that there might be some relationship between certain weather conditions and this anomalous propagation of VHF. So armed with that information, I approached the weather people in Melbourne, and we eventually found that over a period of some weeks, that when this phenomenon occurred, it invariably occurred under the influence of a high pressure. And of course the weather people knew the reason why for that, because generally speaking with a high pressure weather system, a subsidence inversion occurs, which changes the conductive characteristic of the media, and ducts, forms ducting, which lays the VHF energy along the surface of the Earth instead of up into the sky where it normally belongs.
So in the tropospheric region instead of the ionosphere.
Yes, this is right, yes. And you could lay it down at 10,000 feet, 15,000 feet, complete cut-off, and it was all very embarrassing. Well, there was nothing much we could do about it, but it was a relief to know that it wasn't the equipment or our technique at fault. And then the weather people came up with an interesting problem. They were releasing each morning from their headquarters in Melbourne a balloon carrying a radio sonde. The radio sonde, incidentally, was being produced by Radio Corporation in Melbourne, and this gave them air temperature, different heights, barometric pressures, and so on. And then they were able to follow it with a theodolite to get upper wind directions and calculate wind speeds. But this was very good on clear days, but when intense cloud cover occurred, as it does often in Melbourne, they lost sight of their balloon, and of course they lost sight of their upper wind figures. And they approached me and asked me if one of our radars could track their balloon. Really? Well, I didn't know. I'd had nothing to do with it. So I said, well, let's try it, and suck it and cease technique. Yes. But I realised that the little package of the radio sonde wouldn't be satisfactory because of the small reflected signal. So I found a piece of garden stake at a boarding house where I was staying, and I got the PMG workshops to mount two quarter wave length copper rods, quarter inch diameter copper rods at this thing at right angles, and spaced a quarter wavelength apart. Now, I've been asked why I did this, and I'll tell you as we go along, out of sheer ignorance, of course, but I had to try something. We never had a radar in Melbourne. The RAF never had radar in Melbourne or its vicinity at that stage. In fact, I don't think we ever did have. There wasn't any need for it, and were never installed. But the Army had equipment at Williamstown at one of their air searchlight training units, so I arranged with them to use their radar. So we met down at Williamstown. I had the piece of stake with the two dipoles fixed into it. They attached this to their balloon. Well, incidentally, the frequency of operation of the radar was 176 megahertz, and I'd cut the two dipoles half wavelength, yes, for this frequency to get the maximum reflection, because there again I wasn't sure just what range we could expect. So we let this thing go, and it worked marvellously. When I left, the two weather blokes still tracking it. It was about 30 or 40 miles away and at 20,000 feet and still sending back a very useful blip. They were delighted with the setup.
It was a reflected signal, basically.
Oh, yes, off the dipoles.
Yeah, just off the dipoles.
The reason why I put the dipoles at right angles, because I realised that we'd be turning over and all our radar was horizontally polarised, so that at any instant I'd have a reasonably horizontal reflector. Actually, I went to great more lengths than necessary, but at that stage, as I say, it was a matter of suck it and see.
Yeah. Be one of the first circularly polarised aerials, I suppose. Be one of the first circular polarised aerials.
Well, yeah, probably rotating, yes, my word. That worked out very successfully, and of course that technique's used now, and I was just curious to know if anyone else had done that previously, and apparently haven't, because since the article's been published, no one's come to light with any suggestion that they'd use radar for this particular purpose previously.
Was there any effort made to try and use this tropospheric propagation, these longer distances, for early warning sort of system?
No, because it was too erratic.
Yes.
You couldn't depend on it. It may be done, this sort of thing may be available these days, but in those days we had insufficient knowledge to have tried to depend on it. I was going to tell you, this is the question that a number of others ask as a result of this article, why did you go to the trouble of spacing those two dipoles quarter wavelength apart? Because after that was demonstrated and the weather people started to use it, all they did was put two copper wires, 1/8 gauge copper wires, at right angles together in the same plane and let them go. And this was the technique used right throughout the war. Well, the answer to that was that pre-war, I'd done some work on diversity reception with using two antenna quarter wave apart to stop fading or reduce fading, and somewhere tucked away in the back of my mind that this might be an asset in this particular exercise. Yeah. Naturally, it didn't make a scrap of difference, but at that stage I was clutching at straws and just lent on previous background to try and make something work.
Diversity reception, was that for your shortwave, like to improve the shortwave reception for...
Yes. On 10 metres. I was interested in 10 metres in those days. And, it worked out very well. You used two tuners, one on each receiver, and combined the output from the IF stages into the common detector and audio. Or was it common audio? Oh, I just don't recall.
Yeah, it's fairly common these days.
Oh, yes. Oh, well, it was common in those days too, commercially.
Yes.
It worked quite effectively. didn't entirely eliminate fading, but it reduced it to tolerable limits.
Did you have an amateur license yourself, or did you said you had a full license? Was that an amateur or a first class commercial?
No, that was at that stage I had only the amateur license. Yes. That would have been 1938.
When you got your first amateur license?
Yes.
And you're still active as an amateur?
No. Well, that's not quite true. I still retain my license. And I'm still interested in amateur activities, but more in the interest of making equipment than sitting down using it.
Yes.
One of these days I'll get back into it again, but just now I haven't the time.
Do you have any particularly interesting experiences with amateur radio in those times?
No.
Nothing?
No. No, no, nothing out of the ordinary. No, no, just quite normal routine. My first transmissions were on 30 megahertz, and I became interested in 60 megahertz. Yes. So that I had equipment working on both channels, or both frequencies at least, and that's where my interest lay.
John, you are a member of the IRWE. When did you first join
the when they first started here.
Was that back in, what, 32?
Oh, mid-30s. Well, Clifford, though. When was that, Cliff?
32, I think it was. When,
I think it was 31. I'm not sure, but you're a foundation member of the same.
Yes, I think I joined in 32, but I wouldn't be sure. It's too far back.
You'd be somewhere around the foundation member of the institution.
Yes. Yeah, Cliff and I are in the same batch, if I remember right.
Yeah, right. And you're a foundation member, I know.
That's right. Laurie Simons, another one.
Yes.
I think there's only the three of us left now.
Yes, that'd be right.
Well, yes, I don't know whether was Bill Governlock involved in those days?
Yes, Bill was secretary.
Yes. Bill came in just after the war, I think.
Wasn't he not pre-war?
I'm not sure now, but no. He came in as secretary just after the war.
Yeah, that could be right, Cliff, yes. Yeah, I do vaguely remember a chap by the name of Harry... Yes, that is right. I've forgotten his name now. Yes, Bill was definitely post-war. It was Harry somebody was secretary pre-war.
Mm.
But he was the chap that I approached when I wanted to join.
Right. Yeah.
The name of the secretary was Harry Garth.
Oh, well, you can tell us this antidote, and we'll...
I don't know. Well, that's before we put it down on the tape.
It's all right, I've got it running. Yeah,
okay, righto. Well, this is one of the many funny little incidents, or rather tragic little incidents, that occurred in the early days, and it was the sort of thing that we were doing... bearing in mind it was the early stages of the Depression, one tended to chase any business it was offering at all costs. And the building where the Regent Theatre is now in Rundle Street was a row of shops with office space above them and a basement. And down in the basement of this old building was a restaurant. And the restaurant proprietor indicated interest in music for his clients, and somebody brought him across to our workroom and introduced him to one of the large Gold Branson radiograms that we were distributing at that time, a massive thing. Being built in Australia, being built in Sydney, after the duty cut-off importation from America. So it was decided that we should take this thing down into this basement and give the restaurant a demonstration. So my employer's brother and I carried this massive thing down a flight of stairs from the first floor where we were located, along Charles Street, across Rundle Street, and down in the basement of this restaurant and set it up. And then Don said to me, okay, John, switch it on. So I plugged it in and switched it on. There was an almighty bang from the back of the radiogram and a great cloud of smoke, and I realised seconds what had happened and whipped the switch off, but it was far too late. The power transformer primary had disintegrated into a little cloud of smoke, 200 volts DC. Now, this was a problem that we had in the early days, that not only were some buildings DC and others AC, but some parts of buildings were AC and DC, and we got caught out on this one. So it ruined a very expensive radiogram. We carted it back up the stairs from the restaurant across Rundle Street and back up the stairs to the workroom. The dreadful tale of woe for the boss, and there it is. But this is just typical of the things that happened to us in those days.
Yes, I can remember working in Melbourne buildings in my early career, which is later than that. But and it was AC and DC in the same building.
Was it?
Yes, up the top end of Collins Street.
Was it?
Amazing.
Lord.
And there were some buildings up there where there was no AC. We used to have to use a vibrator amplifiers for some jobs.
Used
up there.
Yes.
How many, in those early days, prior to the, or in the early part of the war, when you sort of got asked to, you know, be a radio, join the radio group for the RAF, how many radio people would there have been in South Australia at that time, technical people that would have reasonable knowledge? Do you have any idea? Would there be?
You mean employed manufacturing
side and, yeah, and actively
and service?
And good technical people, yes.
Oh, yes. Well, most of the good ones were members of the IRE, so you could pick up that figure from there initially.
You'd be talking about tens or hundreds?
Top flight people, tens.
Yes.
Yes. Good technicians, hundreds.
Yes. Right. Also, I know that the Ernsmith organisation were making Scharnberg Strauss radios. Was that at a time? Did they start up again after National was sold out to Radio Corporation?
When Ernsmith sold National to Radio Corporation, there was a time stipulated in which they could not go into production again on their own behalf. I don't know what the time was, but after the war had finished, this time had cut out anyway. So Ernst Smith set up their own manufacturing subsidiary again, making this time only receivers for their own retailing.
Ah, right.
And these were named Scharnberg Strauss. But we were making, of course, Scharnberg Strauss needs for Ernst Smith prior to the war, along with all the others.
Yes.
Let's see now. I'm just trying to think some of the names I can't recall offhand. We used to spray the chassis different colours for the different retailers. Burke's had the red. Always had the red chassis, but Myers was Air Voice. Myers' trade name was Air Voice in those days, and their chassis were a particular colour. But they all had their own little pet names. Miller Anderson's had their particular name, which I've forgotten now, and so on.
Yeah, would they have been buying radios from other manufacturers
as
well?
Yes. In that time in Australia, there were numerous small radio houses producing radio equipment for the unbranded trade, putting any brand name on that came along. Extraordinary about it was that we were producing radios at a total cost of approximately console radios, two-valve and rectifier, 8-inch loudspeaker, dynamic loudspeaker, for approximately £3.10. selling them in batches of 100 to the large Rundle Street retailers for £4, making a net 10 shillings on it, and they were retailing them at £4.10, netting 10 shillings, or at least grossing 10 shilling margin.
Incredible.
It's incredible business to look back on.
Yeah, incredible.
We'll never see that again, never again at all. Everybody was just happy to be making a living at that stage in the mid-30s when the depression was really bad.
They probably sold them for 19 guineas retail.
Not those, they didn't. No, they were selling them for £4.10.
Oh.
Oh, the brand, well-known brand names like AWA and Phillips and...
HMV, I suppose.
HMV and others, they were the higher price 19 guinea touches. We were making receivers that would be retailing at that figure, but not the large quantity mass-produced things that were selling for £4.10. So you could have gone along to any of the major retailers in Adelaide and picked up quite a satisfactory receiver for £4.10, and the performance was quite good. We were making a four-valve and rectifier superheterodyne with an autodyne first detector, 57, 58... 57 anode bend detector and a 2A5. And Miller Anderson's bought a batch of these things and sold one to a chap by the name of Wally Young, who was an employee at Holden's down at Woodville. And he went back to Miller Anderson's radio department and told them that he was getting Europe on this just straight broadcast 5-valve superheterodyne receiver, and they just wiped him off as some sort of a clown. So he said, they eventually told him they weren't interested in the fact that he was getting European stations. You better go along and talk to the manufacturer about it. They might be interested. So he bobbed up at our workroom or little factory. And sure enough, I went down there at 2 o'clock in the morning. He was picking up even Brussels and Berlin and Paris and London on the broadcast band.
Yes.
Quite good signal strength. And this, of course, could be done at that time of the day without the local broadcast stations being on the air. And... Well, a path of darkness most of the way, not all the way, but a lot of the way, and the medium frequencies are getting through from Europe to Adelaide, and he had a conventional chimney to one pole, long wire aerial system, but he was the only bloke that I ever knew, or only person that I ever knew, who actually achieved that.
Yes, we've heard of it happening in the Northern Territory.
Oh, yes.
But, of course, they're so far away that none of the local stations...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but in the middle of the night now, you can pick up local radio stations from
all over
Australia.
Yes. I can remember listening to KFI, I think it was, in Los Angeles in the winter months, just at sunset here, just after sunset, and a path of darkness all the way back to the west coast of America on a little two-and rectifier, a regenerative two-banger rectifier on a large aerial, of course.
Yes.
But then when 5CK started up, well, that was the end of KFI of a Sunday evening.
We used to get KZRM from Manila before 5CK started.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just about the same frequency.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, there was quite a few stations from that area. Radio Saigon, Khabarovsk, or some such name, in Russian, the Russian territory. Quite a lot of the main cities down that east coast of Asia would come through at night on the broadcast band, but only when the local stations are off the air.
Yes. Yeah, you mentioned earlier about you were doing this course at the School of Mines.
Yes.
Could you give us a bit of an idea what, you know, what a course would consist of in those times? This was before the war, wasn't it?
Well, I still have my notebooks. Oh, yeah, this was pre-war.
Yes.
Yeah, this would be 1935, 36. It's just started off with basic theory. Very elementary.
What would be the duration of the course? Be what, one or two evenings a week or something like
two
that?
Two evenings a week, one evening theory and one evening practical.
Yes.
I know I went for 2 years and I may have done a third. I just can't recall now. Or I may have started the third and then had to give it away.
And Wilf Honner was a...
Wilf Honner and his brother Jack and... Oh, the little short chap from the tramways. One of the very early foundation members. Stan Acklin, that's right. Wilf Honner was in charge, the senior man. His brother Jack, also from the tramways, and Stan Acklin, they were electrical engineers. The tramways, they were the three that were running it, and it was a particularly good course for someone in my position. The university had nothing. You could do electrical engineering or you could do physics or science, but there was no electronic or no radio aspect dealt with. So it worked out very well.
Yeah. Wilf Honner, he went on to become involved with the AWV, didn't he? The Bell Company.
AWV, that's right. Yeah. Was it
the Bell Company or...?
No, AWA. He became in charge of research at AWA, finally, yes. He could have been associated with AWV, but...
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I just remember
AWA, anyway, would be right. He was quite a good bloke, a very good instructor. And our final effort, final practical, was making a building a transmitter on 60 megs and getting it going and working a few local amateurs and... that was the end of the course. It helped me a lot because at that stage I was getting involved with the first class ticket, starting to brush up on Morse and regulations and what have you. So it all tied in nicely. So over a period of 5 years, starting with the School of Mines and finished with the first class commercial ticket. It was very worthwhile.
How did you get on doing a Morse in those days for Morse training?
Oh, we had a wizard, Arthur Sheard. Arthur Sheard was an ex-PMG telegraphist who had spent some time at Eucla, in the old telegraph station that was Eucla, set up in Eucla in the early days. Spent some time there, and then he came back to Adelaide. I don't know why he left PMG, but he became associated with the Advertiser, copying interstate traffic between newspapers and the Australian Associated Press, whatever it was in those days. And he set up a class. This would have been about 1938 in his home at Prospect.
Yes.
And he had dozens of would-be telegraphists out there. And he got me up to the 30 words a minute for the first-class commercial ticket. And then I went back and helped him. I used to send for him for the beginners in one of the little side rooms that he had there. But he had signed verification of receiving 57 words a minute. And Johnny DeCure verified this. He said, I've been with him. Johnny DeCure was a radio inspector here in Adelaide.
I remember the name.
And he said, I've been with Arthur Shear when he's copied 50 to 60 words a minute.
Yes.
And he didn't write it down as he was receiving. Of course, you couldn't do that. He'd write it, continue writing seconds or minutes after he'd taken the message, and that's the only way you could do it at that speed.
Yes.
Well, he was the chap that got me up to the necessary speed for the first class ticket, and the rest of it was just brute force swatting.
Yeah, you would have been one of the first people to get a first-class ticket in this state, would you?
No, I shouldn't think so. No. Well, I couldn't answer that, no. Ian. I don't know how many would have had it prior to that.
Would it be on that basis, would that be the kind of background that would have got you into the RAF?
Yes,
the commission
very definitely. Start? Yes. Yeah, very definitely, yes.
Yeah.
Experience in production and design and production, plus first-class commercial ticket.
Yeah.
Was infinitely more valuable than a degree in electrical engineering, because I could sort out problems with transmitters and transmitting aerials, which I had to do at odd times.
Yes.
Because I'd had this experience.
Yeah, the practical.
Whereas the chaps on course with us who were highly qualified science masters from high school and so on, had no knowledge of transmitters or receivers at all. Transmitting aerials my background, my pre-war background, got us out of a lot of trouble. Not only me, but others with the same background were able to sort the troubles out. When I first joined 6th Squadron, I reported to the CO, Squadron Leader Mick Maynard, a very nice chap, and he said, right, I'm just about to go off on a late afternoon anti-sub patrol, you can come with me, get a bit of experience that way. So we're just agreeing that this will be what my first job would be, and a flight sergeant jumped at the up at the doorway of the, incidentally the CO's office was a aircraft container box car with a door on it and a window in it. Nothing was wasted in those days. Panting his head off, this flight sergeant signals to report that the CO's Hudson radio was unserviceable. So the CO looked at me and he said, Sergeant, Pilot Officer Allen's just finished radar school. He'll be the man to sort this out.
Yeah.
Anything to do with a black box and you were some sort of a genius. So I rather nervously hopped in the Jeep with the CO and the flight sergeant, went down to the Hudson aircraft with a presumably faulty radio equipment. Without looking around, I climbed up behind them into the aircraft, and it was an 85 AR-8, a thing I'd heard of but not seen before. But it was quite straightforward, and I tuned it up, and there was joy going up the feeder to the outside antenna, of the order of 1 to 1.5 amps. So I was quite happy that the equipment was okay. So I got down outside again and stepped back in the front of the aircraft, and the penny dropped. There was nothing wrong with the aerial system, but the aircraft was in a bomb-proof shelter, blast-proof shelter, with a wire mesh across the top about 6 inches above the antenna. And covered with branches of trees, good camouflage. Well, what was happening is all the RF was being dissipated in this wire mesh, you see. So I said to the flight sergeant, pull the aircraft out from under that cover, she'll work. You know, and that fixed me for all time with that squadron. Some sort of a ruddy genius. And all the result there was simply that I'd had the background, the previous experience, that when I saw the situation, I recognised the nature of the problem.
Yeah.
And this is just an example. This went on well, and I've reported the business with the VHF anomalous propagation.
Yes.
These kept bobbing up, and having a background I could lean on to sort it out, I did see.
Yes.
And there it is.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting little
facets there. This went on continuously, never a dull moment.